Hi everyone, in this episode of Dear Analyst, I'm going to be talking about my top five, that's right, top five favorite Excel shortcuts. Now I think in the first episode, I think I got a little too deep with the topic there, and I thought for this one I bring a little more high level and make this episode a little more relatable to more Excel and data analysts out there who may be new to Excel, maybe new to data analysis, and just want some simple tips and tricks for getting better in Excel. So if you're a hardcore Excel user, this might not be as interesting for you, but definitely stick around for the second half when I review some of my favorite podcast episodes relating to data, software, and other related topics. So in terms of Excel keyboard shortcuts, I love them. Having been a financial analyst in a previous life, I basically was using Excel keyboard shortcuts all the time because you have to be efficient and productive with how you're building reports, building models, and just knowing how to navigate an Excel file without having to use the mouse is really key and tantamount to being a really good analyst. If you are maybe just doing modeling, you might not have to know all the keyboard shortcuts, but I think even if you're modeling, it still pays dividends to know these shortcuts. So here are my top five. So they're kind of arranged in a somewhat, I guess, from least important to most important, but I mean, I guess these are all important because they're my top five. But number five is seeing a formula in a cell. It's such a simple shortcut, but using the keyboard for this is 10 times better than using the mouse or the trackpad on your keyboard, on your laptop. And it's simply the F2 key if you're on the PC, which is in the top left of your keyboard, or Control plus letter U on a Mac. And if you are on a laptop, a PC laptop, the F2 key might be something like increase brightness or decrease volume, which kind of sucks because that means you have to press the FN key, which is like this like weird key in the bottom of your keyboard, then the F2 key to actually make the F2 key work. Not the ideal scenario, but you can still make it happen by basically making a setting in your laptop so that the function keys at the top automatically work without having you to press the FN key at the bottom of your keyboard. So if you're on a full keyboard, however, perhaps on a desktop PC, the F2 key allows you to get into the cell or get into the edit formula, and then escape basically gets you out of the formula. Really, really simple, right? And so really common pattern for analysts out there, at least for what I do, is you're pressing F2 escape a lot because you're going into the formula, maybe writing some formula stuff, then going out of it and seeing how the data reacts. Or how the data recalculates. So you're constantly switching into this like edit formula mode and then looking to see how numbers actually pan out. I think one interesting note is that sometimes you'll see somebody who has the F1 key missing on their keyboard. And that's because the F1 key is obviously jammed right in the middle between the F2 and the escape key. And so when you're pressing F2 and escape a lot, when you're debugging a formula, if you accidentally press the F1 key, it launches the Excel help dialog box or menu. And you basically like lose a few seconds of time from having that help dialog pop up, which is really annoying. So that's why like heavy Excel users will literally remove the F1 key from their keyboard so that they don't accidentally hit it and then bring up this help menu, which you basically never use. Because the help menu is like searching for what does like the sum formula do when you can easily just do that in Google. So the help dialog box is really just kind of pointless if you are at any level of expertise in Excel. So Not saying you should remove the F1 key today, but maybe down the line, if you are using Excel a lot, you probably might find yourself taking that key off because it's super annoying when you accidentally hit it and it brings up the help Excel help dialog box. Number four, selecting ranges of data. And when I say ranges, I just mean a bunch of cells at the same time. And this is a shortcut on the PC is simply Control plus the Shift key and then the arrow keys. So this is Control and Shift with your left hand and then the arrow keys with your right hand. On the Mac, it's Command and Shift plus the arrow keys. Now, when you get better at it, you can actually let go of the Control key and just hold down the Shift key by itself and the arrow keys, and you select one row and one column at a time. Whereas when you hold down Control and Shift and the arrow keys, it selects a bunch of cells up until there's a cell without a value. So if you have a bunch of cells from A1 to, let's say, C10, if you press Control Shift Right in cell A1, it goes all the way from A1 to C1. And then if you hold down Control and Shift and down arrow, it goes from C1 to C10. So in two keystrokes, you can select all of the entire box range. This is one keyboard shortcut I like using just because it's much more efficient than using the mouse and or the trackpad. And as you get better at it, you're going to find yourself switching back and forth between holding Control and Shift with arrow keys and then Shift by itself with the arrow keys. So definitely make note of that one if you aren't already using it today. Number three, filling a formula down or to the right. I believe it's the same shortcut, Excel keyboard shortcut on both PC and Mac, and it is Control plus letter D for down to fill the formula down, or Control plus letter R to fill the formula to the right. So if you create a long formula in Excel and you want to copy it over to a bunch of other cells, you might be dragging and dropping like the bottom right-hand corner of the cell that has a formula down or to the right to maybe basically copy it over to a bunch of empty cells. That's doable, but imagine you have to do that across hundreds and thousands of rows. It becomes a pain in the ass. So instead, you can select all the empty cells below or to the right of the cell with the formula, and then with the cell that has a formula in the first part of the selection, you can press Control D or Control R and it automatically kind of copies and pastes the formula for you down or to the right in your Excel file. Now, this becomes really helpful when you have a really, really long Excel formula that has nested if statements and a bunch of index match, VLOOKUPs, offsets. It becomes a much faster way to copy that formula to a bunch of cells without you having to basically use your mouse and drag and drop and basically get a hurt wrist from holding down the mouse or the trackpad. So that's number three. Number two, auto-summing a range of values. This seems really stupid. Like, why would this be a shortcut and why is it useful? First, I'll describe the shortcut and you'll be like, why is there a shortcut for this? But then I'll describe the scenario and it might become more clear why I think this is number two on my list. So if you have a bunch of numbers in, let's say, 10 rows, and you want to sum those numbers up, you can just write at the bottom of those cells equals sum, S-U-M, left parentheses, and then reference those cells, you know, A1 to A10 or whatever. That's super easy to do because you can literally write equals SU, hit tab, and then you can start referencing the cells. But then after you hit the tab, you have to actually press the up arrow once and then select all the cells above that empty cell to make sure that Excel knows what the cell reference is to put into that sum formula. So this is fine, but imagine having to do that many times over and over again. And you can see how having to write equals sum and then selecting all the cells becomes a pain in the butt. Now, auto-summing a range of values on the PC, you literally just press, while you're in the empty cell that should contain the sum, you just press the Alt key with your right thumb and then the equal sign with like your right middle finger. So you press Alt equals, And Excel does two things. Number one, it automatically fills in or writes in the equals sum formula for you into that cell when you press Alt equals. And number two, it automatically pulls all the cells above that empty cell and throws that into the sum formula as the cell reference. So you don't have to go in and actually select the cells you want to sum anymore. Excel kind of smartly looks at your formula, looks at your data, and says, okay, I think I know what you're trying to do. You're trying to basically sum a bunch of numbers above this cell. Let me just throw all those numbers into the sum formula so that you can go on with the rest of your day. And that those two steps right there have saved me so much time. I can't tell you, because when I'm trying to sum a bunch of random stuff, whether it's at the bottom of a bunch of rows or at the right of a bunch of columns, that sum formula just prevents you from having to select any cells and from having to write sum all the time. And the scenario where this comes into play is sometimes you get a huge data set back from, let's say, your engineers or your databases, and you have, let's say, a million rows of data, of numbers, and you quickly just want to sum up like what all those numbers are. Now, you could, again, write equals sum and then select all those million rows, but that's kind of a pain in the butt, and it's kind of prone to human error if you don't know how you're selecting the data correctly. Instead, you go to the very bottom of the column with all the numbers, hit Alt equals, and Excel will automatically, again, number one, create the sum formula for you. And number two, it will take all the numbers from rows one, A1 to A a million, and throw that in as a cell reference to the sum formula. And then all you have to do is press Enter. Actually, I think now you can just press Alt equals and it automatically hits Enter for you. And so you basically can do all this in one keystroke, which is pretty darn awesome. On the Mac, the keyboard shortcut, I believe, is Shift Command and the letter T for total, I assume. So it's a little more difficult on the Mac, but it has the same kind of effect as it does on the PC. So that's number two. So what is my favorite Excel keyboard shortcut of all time? Number one, if you are an Excel guru, data analyst, consultant, banker, you probably may also agree with me on this. If you don't, I'm curious to hear why you don't agree. But number one most used Excel keyboard shortcut for me, paste special values. This is funny because paste special values, in my first episode, I actually railed on this operation in Excel. I actually think it's an anti-pattern for how you should be working in Excel and more broadly working with data and data sets in Excel. And having said all that and all the things I hate about paste special values, it's still the number one shortcut I use when I'm using Excel, because I just want to quickly take the output from my data analysis, put it into another spreadsheet, and just manipulate that extra data really quickly to maybe copy and paste and put into a PowerPoint or put into or print out to a PDF. It's just a way to quickly format some numbers without having to worry about the underlying formulas changing at all. And it's just, you know, you're copying some value, you're basically copying numbers usually from a bunch of cells where you have formulas and pasting those numbers, just the numbers, not the formulas, in or the formats, into another spreadsheet where you can do some more downstream formatting and analysis. And yeah, I can't say how much, especially as a financial analyst, when you're doing a lot of reporting, this keyboard shortcut saves you so much time when it comes to having to format your reports and format your data and still maintain the underlying formula structure of your file. Again, I actually try to steer away from using this shortcut more because I don't believe in paste special values, because it's not a scalable way to organize and share your data. But when you have to do some really ad hoc one-off analysis, especially when it relates to reporting and dashboarding, can't say how important paste special values is for this. So there you have it, my top five. Number five, again, C formula in a cell. I didn't even say for number one, what is the shortcut for paste special values? In case you don't know, you can just Google this too. Well, here's an important note. I learned Excel actually on version 2003, believe it or not. And the keyboard shortcut for paste special values on Excel version 2003 was Alt ESV and then the letter V again, enter. I think on newer versions of Excel, it's just like Control Alt V, I believe. I don't even know. I still use the old school keyboard shortcut. And on the Mac, it is Command Control V and then V for values. So it's kind of like a little bit of a wonky shortcut, keyboard strokes, but it works. So there you have it. Number five, again, C formula in a cell, pressing the function 2 key. Number four, selecting ranges of data with Control and Shift and the arrow keys. Number three, filling a formula down and to the right with Control D or Control R. Number two, auto summing a range of values, Alt plus the equal sign. And then number one, as we just discussed, paste special values, Alt ESV V enter. And that's again for the old school 2003 keyboard shortcut, but it still works in new versions of Excel. So there you have it. Those are my top five most used Excel keyboard shortcuts. And I would say there's probably five more I could throw in there, but I think for now, to keep this nice and short, we'll keep it at those five. And curious to hear what keyboard shortcuts you use. And now I'm going to go on to the second part of this episode and just talk about some recent and not so recent episodes I listened to other from other podcasts I found interesting and relevant, and I'll try my best to tie it back into Excel and data if I can. So the first one I came across was actually listening to this actually, I don't know why, so many of my favorite episodes are coming from the Changelog podcast. But the Changelog is, I guess, a group of podcasts about JavaScript, engineering, creating your own startup, I believe. And they had a wrap-up show at the end of 2018, episode 328, and they mentioned one episode that from 2018 that was one of their most I guess influential episodes for the two the hosts of the show. And that episode they mentioned on the recap of 2018 was episode 205 with Peter, I'm going to butcher his name, Peter Hingens, I believe. And actually, this episode was from two. The original episode 205 was actually published in 2016, so I'm not sure why it ended up in the 2018 recap. Anyways, this episode was called A Protocol for Dying, and it was actually kind of a very emotional and serious episode to get on the emotional bit for a second. Peter Hingens is a lifelong programmer and coder, and he was creator of 0MQ and the Collective Code Construction Contract, C4. He has written many books about coding, and in this episode, he was actually talking. He was talking about, I guess, a blog post he wrote called "A Protocol for Dying," because at the time of the recording, he was actually diagnosed with cancer in his lungs, and it was a really, really just crazy emotional episode, but Peter kept it pretty, very professional, and he was talking about coding and all his accomplishments and works over the years. But most of the episode was him talking about how he knows he's going to die. And there was one part in the episode that really stood out to me. I don't remember when was an episode, but they were interviewing him, and he was talking about, his protocol is about how, since he was the creator of these different frameworks and books, and he was managing different communities, since he knew he was going to pass away, he wanted to decentralize the power, or I guess the influence that he had over these communities and these projects. And he basically said that he wanted to be as unimportant as possible to the people that are relying on him. Not only family, but also the code and the coding communities that he created, because he doesn't want to be this the point of failure, because he's obviously going to, the time was going to pass away. So he wanted to figure out a way to transition all of his responsibilities to the community, which seems like a very understandable thing to do. And there's one part of the episode, and this has nothing to do with Data or Excel, but there's one part of the episode when the hosts were interviewing him and he was talking about his protocol for dying. And in the background, in his audio, you could actually hear his kids. They must have been really young, and they were like, you know, kind of yelling and screaming and just saying daddy or something like that. And that just, those few seconds when you hear his kids talking in the background of his audio, of his, you know, I'm guessing he was doing it in his house and his family was around. And that just hit a really big, a little bit of an emotional string in me, because he was being so straightforward and so transparent about what he's doing to prepare for the inevitability. Yet you could hear his family kind of in the background as this was going on. Obviously it was a very interesting episode to hear about his work, but more importantly, how does someone, I guess, transition from all of his, all these accomplishments, not only for work, but for family, to basically not being alive anymore. Definitely not a very fun and happy episode, but that moment right there was really, really something. So definitely check out episode 205 from the changelog. And I think what the host said was that this was one of their most most emotional and important episodes from their podcast, and I completely agree with them. And it also taught me a lot about what I will do when I eventually face the inevitability of death. So yeah, that was the first one that I wanted to call out. Sorry to keep it so deep. Sorry to be the Debbie Downer today, but we'll move on to some more, I guess, relevant topics for this podcast. I'm a big fan of the Tim Ferriss Show. I think many people that listen to podcasts or either know of Tim Ferriss or know about his podcast. And in episode 353, he interviewed Patrick Collison, the CEO of Stripe. And around the 52-minute mark of this episode, the CEO, Patrick, said some really important things about big companies not being able to create really good software products. The general gist was a lot of big companies, they have really expensive buildings and can deploy capital on physical assets and other things like that. But when it comes to building a really great piece of software, most companies, big companies, just suck at it because they maybe are just hindered by resources, or not resources, but just by like human talent or by prioritization, product prioritization kind of forces. And when you think about it, like if you think about any big company that you know about today that has like an app or a website, what he's saying is that those websites and apps pretty much suck because like the animations don't work or the color is off or there's a bug. And even though these big companies have so much capital, they just don't know how to get software right. And for, I think the point he was trying to make was, if you are a small software startup and you can, you know how, and you have like a piece of software application that has a modicum of success, and you know how to prioritize the features that your users want, you can totally kill, not kill, but you can totally win on just building a really awesome piece of software that it would take a long time for a big company to have, that has 100x more resources and capital than you do. And I guess this is kind of how they thought about building Stripe. But when I think about, I think when you think about starting a company or starting a new product, you think about the branding and the webs and like, you know, the website, but the, you think about like the social media handles and the name of the company. And at the end of the day, a lot of this stuff really doesn't matter in the beginning, because all that matters is that the software just looks and feels and works well for the end user. And I think that's a really good tip that he brought out in this episode with Tim Ferriss. So yeah, I think just being able to prioritize the right features for your small software application, if you're building one, that's going to be, believe it or not, put you in an advantage over a lot of bigger companies who have just boatloads of cash to invest in things that may not contribute to the best piece of software. All right, the next episode, again, from the changelog. I think part of the reason why there's so many good episodes from the changelog is because they just pump out so many episodes, and I guess there's a lot more of them listening to in my feed. But this one was number 331. The title was GitHub Actions is the Next Big Thing. And the hosts Adam and Gerard talked to Kyle Daigle. He's the director of ecosystem engineering at GitHub. And around minute 7:36, he said a few things about developer tools that I thought was really interesting. And I'm not sure I completely agree with it, but I guess we'll see what you guys think. But what he said was companies that are, this is similar to what Patrick from the CEO of Stripe was saying, was that companies that are focusing on one really niche tool for developers will have a competitive advantage over a company that's trying to build a tool that can do a bunch of different things for developers. So he was saying, you know, I think he was talking about some company that does like something interesting or unique about pull requests. And that took off with a lot of developers because it just added so much value to the developer experience. And when you are developing a tool for developers, it has to be for a very niche market. And that gives you an advantage over a lot of other companies. And I think this goes to really any company, not just for developer tools, but for anyone that thinks that, oh, I'm trying to build a new company or a new platform that can do 1,000 different things, but you end up doing 1,000 different things just a little well. But what I think Kyle was saying in this episode was just do one or two things really well and just own that experience for the user and you'll win. And I think the example he brought up was how a lot of companies say, oh, we just do CI, continuous integration for all your developer experience. And that's a whole lot of different things because there's a lot of different things that go into that pipeline. But if you can just do one thing really well related to pull requests, for instance, that would be a killer feature, if you will, that Amazon or Google Cloud or Microsoft Azure may not spend time doing because they're so much focused on the broader ecosystem. And I think he was saying they have an advantage on just CPUs. Like you're never going to be able to build as many data centers as Amazon. And so they have that optimized, but it's all the things that are unique to the developer experience where you can build something that's really powerful and sticky for developers. And I think more broadly speaking, this is, I think the one thing I took away from this was just trying to build something for a niche market. Instead of trying to build the next Uber, you try to build the next Uber for, I don't know, stay-at-home moms who are over 50 and live in Phoenix. There's probably specific nuances about that market that Uber doesn't understand, and you can really have a competitive advantage if you can build the right feature set. So that's just the last one thing I took away from that episode. Now, the last one is from a little more unknown podcast, I would say, called The Pylon Show. And this was episode number 36. What is The Pylon Show? So quick background. I love the game of StarCraft. I started playing StarCraft when I was in middle school. StarCraft 2 came out, I believe, in 2009. Let me see when it came out. Anyways, it's a real-time strategy game where you're building bases and building units, and you have to attack other people and attack other bases. And I actually I play quite a bit with my colleagues at work. It came out in 2010, so just under 10 years ago. And it's a really fun game because it makes you think about how to create resources, how to effectively deploy them, when to build certain units, when to build certain buildings, how to counterattack someone who's attacking you, how to attack someone without them noticing you. And there's just all these different things about the game and so many different variables. And the one thing that makes the game really awesome is that it's very well balanced. There's three different races you can play, and it's all the different races have different units, and you think one race is better than the other, but they're actually all very balanced, and kudos to Blizzard for making such an awesome game. And I am still playing it after all these years, so it just shows how awesome this game is. Anyway, the Pylon Show, this episode, 36, they talked about the AI machine, Alpha Star, I believe, that basically beat a bunch of professional StarCraft II gamers like TLO, for instance. And the episode kind of went into this realm of like, oh, like, is AI taking over the world? And if we can't even beat the AI in StarCraft II, like, imagine us trying to beat the AI in something else that's like more like life-threatening. And it kind of devolved into a conversation about how AI could or could not be bad. So that was, that whole thing in itself, the AI thing, is like very interesting. But near minute 1 hour and 46, they started answering questions from, I guess, people that emailed in questions from their community and audience. And one of the questions was, how do you attract new StarCraft II players to StarCraft without them feeling like it's overwhelming or too hard of a game to learn? And I actually thought that was a really interesting question, because StarCraft II is kind of a complicated game, and it does take a little bit while to learn, but once you get into it, it's like obviously very addicting. And the answer was to the, what I think what one of the hosts, what his answer was talking about was a good StarCraft player will tell a new StarCraft player how to play the perfect way. And what I mean by that is, right when the game starts, you build specific things, and then you have to, at this second, you have to then build that. And then after this happens, you have to build exactly 10 Marines. And after 10 Marines, you have to start building the factory. And there's like a step-by-step build order about how to play correctly. And that's a trap that I guess really good StarCraft players make when trying to teach the game to a newbie, is that they try to teach the way, the perfect way to play. Whereas the best way to teach a new person, or to, I guess, retain a new player, is to tell them, this is a fun game. You shouldn't have to feel like you have to do everything step by step to optimize your playing performance. The host of the show said it should feel more like a canvas, like kind of like a Bob Ross kind of thing, where you have a blank canvas and you can paint it any way you want. And the same thing can be applied to StarCraft. For instance, you might build like 100 Marines just for the fun of it, because it looks crazy and it looks fun. But guess what? At least you're experimenting with that. And you basically make a bunch of mistakes and you just have fun. And I think that's really the right way to play it, is just to build stuff and experiment and see how building 100 Marines and one tank is not really the best mix of an army, but allows you to kind of see how that army mix would perform under certain situations. And that to me was like one of the big takeaways, was not just for StarCraft, but even in Excel or any other kind of, if you're into coding or building any kind of project, is you think there's a perfect way of doing things. And if you follow a tutorial or follow a website on how to build something, it's inevitably going to not generate happiness for you. And you're probably not going to feel very passionate about it, because you aren't treating it as an open canvas where you can be creative and utilize your creative skill set. And I know StarCraft is kind of like a weird analogy, but that's exactly the kind of game it is that even today I'm still playing it and trying to be creative and thinking of new unit army mixes I can create. And I wonder if I do this in a game, will it work? And I'm always experimenting and always failing, but I think that's what makes StarCraft a fun game, is that it is an open canvas and it is something that you can do you can try multiple permutations of things, and it may not work, but it may work. And I think when it comes to your projects, whether you're working in Excel or data, don't feel like you have to write the perfect formula every time. And there's multiple ways of getting the formula right. And so treating your Excel file as a blank canvas, you know, just channeling my inner Bob Ross here, that is a good way to think about using Excel, playing with data, in that you don't have to stick to a certain conventions. Just have fun with it, and you never know what you'll discover in terms of new formulas or new hacks. That's essentially how a lot of formulas you see today from consultants and from bankers, that's how they originally came about, was from people experimenting by, I think the proper term for it is composing different formulas together. Who knew you could put an if statement in a VLOOKUP statement? Who knew the power of index match together versus having those formulas by themselves? Treat this as an open canvas. So yeah, those were the four episodes that I thought were really interesting from the last few weeks. And I think ending on the StarCraft one was a good one, just given how fun the game is to me and how I think... actually, one thing you should definitely look up is look up on Quora ways that StarCraft can benefit your life. Someone did a really good write-up on Quora about how the game of StarCraft has helped him or her with business and in life, because it helps. There's so many skills you can learn from the game that can apply to real life. All right. I think I talked more about the podcasts I listen to versus Excel, but you know, it is the way it is. So thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you guys next time.